construction and renovation for homeowners and local businesses since 1992. 525-7740.
It's 3:59 and you are tuned to WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, 99.9 Bangor, and streaming online everywhere at WERU.org. And this is Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal for October 11th, 2012. I'm Amy Brown. The fall season of the University of Maine's weekly Socialist and Marxist Studies lecture series on controversial topics is now underway. The topic on October 4th was, quote, "Neither Here Nor There, the Conceptual Paradoxes of Immigrant and Asylee Resistance," presented by Professor Robert Glover of the Honors and Political Sciences departments. His talk was recorded by WERU's John Greenman. Part one aired yesterday on the news report. Today we bring you part two.
Definitions of who is outside of the political community can foster solidarity among our fellow citizens, but they can also foster demonization. They can give us a sense of belonging, but they can also create this kind of vitriol towards any manifestation of difference, any deviation from that norm. And I think we saw that in the 2000s with the way people reacted to migrants in the wake of 9/11. They just became symbolic of this outside that we needed to fear. So Michael Ignatieff, scholar of human rights, he says the process of creating an outside to the political community is probably the most common form of tyranny in human history. The seemingly straightforward sovereign act of defining boundaries is one that's rich with conceptual and analytical complexity. And so because of that, numerous scholars have turned to that relationship. They've turned to situations like this. They said, okay, we're going to analyze this because something really interesting is happening here. It's not simply just a matter of policy, but it digs deeper into how we understand the political community and how the political community defines itself. So essentially, they're looking at these cases and they're saying, of what is this an instance? Right? What are we seeing here? What's the character of these developments? How should we understand actions taken by sovereign governments in relation to migrants and asylees? And also, how should we understand their counteractions? How should we understand the ways that they respond to these forms of state action, the ways that they potentially resist it or accept it? And so a lot of the work that I do kind of deals with the way that these questions are answered and the way that these questions are explored in a field called critical migration studies. So folks that look at migration, but they dig into that more rich complexity that lies underneath. It's not simply about understanding how we can have more effective borders, but it's understanding the role that borders play in a meaningful conceptual sense in terms of how we understand the political community. And those that study this in critical migration studies, there's kind of two dominant strains of thought. The first is informed by this innovative and influential work of an Italian thinker named Giorgio Agamben, and that constitutes their point of departure. So I focus here on Agamben, but what I'm really looking at is all of the folks that utilize Agamben to understand contemporary migration and asylum policy. Agamben has consistently attended to the qualities of vulnerability and fragility that exist in the contemporary world, and in a really thought-provoking and unsettling way. Agamben argues that in the contemporary context of sovereign power, the normative aspect of law can be obliterated and contradicted with impunity by a governmental violence that, while ignoring international law externally and producing a permanent state of exception internally, nevertheless still claims to be applying the law. The example that Agamben consistently uses is Camp X-Ray at Guantanamo Bay. You think of this kind of weird situation of limbo in which detainees at Camp X-Ray find themselves, seemingly subject neither to the demands of domestic law that we would have in the United States, nor the international legal conventions that exist for prisoners of war. We define them as enemy combatants. We create a new category. And by creating a new category, by the state creating a new category, we're no longer bound to the restrictions that characterize the old categories. So we create this new space, which, as Agamben would say, is ignoring international law externally and producing a permanent state of exception internally, nevertheless still claiming to be applying the law. The contemporary political subject, in turn, now confronts the whims of sovereign power characterized by what Agamben called bear life. It's this form of ambiguity. It's a space devoid of rights and subject to the whims of sovereign power admits a permanent state of exception, right? That state of exception that we declare eventually becomes kind of the permanent way that we operate. The state becomes this powerful but ambiguous entity, and we face it characterized by bare life. And so in thinking about the contemporary status of migrants and asylum seekers, we gain a sense of why Agamben has had such an impact. When we look at the condition of migrants and asylum seekers, we see that their experiences seem to embody the conditions of bare life that Agamben articulates. Walters writes that Agamben draws our attention to the ambiguous gray zone between the inside and the outside, the social condition of being neither fully excluded nor fully recognized. And for those critically analyzing migration and asylum politics, the bewildering and ambiguous states in which many migrants find themselves kind of resonates with Agamben's vision. Right? It seems to parallel that vision, even though it's a bleak vision. But there's a danger in this. In thinking critically about Agamben's contributions to understanding the citizenship migration nexus, we have to also be cautious of what Walters calls the sometimes hubristic and vaguely apocalyptic nature of his enterprise. He writes, in Agamben's account, and even more so in much of the research that has explored its themes in the context of migration studies, refugees and migrants are depicted as cast into spaces at the limit of law, contained outside the system of legal protection, trapped in zones of indistinction. In these kind of accounts, they are subjects to whom all manner of things are done, often in arbitrary and violent ways, but rarely agents in their own right. So the danger with Agamben is that it denies the agency, the political autonomy of these individuals. Even though they are unlikely political actors, they still engage in agency. These forms of protest still, you know, they show us the ways that they engage in political agency. But utilizing Agamben as your base for understanding this doesn't necessarily allow you to recognize that. So that's kind of the first perspective. The second perspective, and that's a really bleak perspective. I think Agamben is, you know, troubling and disconcerting to read, and that's one of his benefits, but it can make us misunderstand certain situations. The second perspective is kind of a cosmopolitan perspective. And this, there's a lot of folks within migration studies that draw on the work of Shayla Benavieve. Shayla Benavieve is a political theorist, and she sees in the emergence of international law, human rights norms, international courts, which can actually adjudicate international law. She sees the emergence of this kind of new legal and political space, which is occurring above and beyond the state as we know it. And she focuses on Europe quite a bit. Right? If you think of all the developments that are happening with the European Union, European Court of Human Rights, you can see how one might look at that and say, yeah, there's this new legal space that's evolving. And your rights as a human being are no longer tied simply to the state in which you reside, but there's these new, there's this new legal density to how you can pursue your rights. And this is obviously, it's not bleak, it's not apocalyptic, but it's a more positive view. Her vision, if you utilize her thought as your basis for understanding these developments, you see global legal and institutional changes that have opened spaces for agency, democratic empowerment, rights expansion. Benavieve herself, she argues that we're witnessing a disaggregation of citizenship rights in which civil, political, and social rights traditionally associated with citizenship are being unbundled from membership in a national state. So we begin to have rights and we can claim those rights even though we might not be a citizen of a state. Right. So she would look at the case of these migrants engaged in political activism, she would say, yeah, they're not citizens of the state, but they're making rights claims upon that state. And that's something that they can now do. She would do the same thing with asylum. And she presents disaggregation as an inescapable aspect of contemporary globalization. So as international norms and human rights regimes increasingly pry open spaces for non-members to push for inclusion, They gain rights and benefits no matter where they are, whether they're in their country of origin or they're someplace else. Elsewhere, she suggests the political transformation fostered by disaggregation produces a dialectic of rights and identities in which both the identities involved and the meanings of the rights claims are reappropriated, resignified, imbued with new and different meanings. She calls this democratic iteration, meaning that these individuals that we look at in three cases, they not only can make rights claims, but they change the nature of the rights themselves. They kind of reappropriate the rights and define the rights in new ways. And she says that these iterations, these are the first steps towards a more porous notion of political membership and a transnational right to hospitality. She says, these individuals serve as indicators of a new sense of global justice. They are harbingers of new modalities of political agency, perhaps heralding cosmopolitan citizenship. So this is obviously, it's very optimistic, right? And it's appealing. You know, the notion that individuals who are vulnerable, no matter where they are, have this discourse of human rights that they can appeal to. They can utilize NGOs to push for their rights. They can utilize international legal institutions to seek their rights. It's kind of a nice vision of the world, and as a normative conception, as what we would want to see, or something towards which we should strive, that might work. But the problem is, Benabib presents this as an empirical reality. Right? She says this is happening. And in fact, she says it's inevitable. Right? It's an inescapable aspect of contemporary globalization. So something about globalization is pushing us in this direction of new legal forms in which people, you know, are no longer simply citizens of the country in which they reside, but they're these kind of global citizens, they have human rights. And that's a more problematic conception as an empirical reality. I think ultimately to claim such a reality is already being constructed kind of ignores some of the more problematic aspects, right? That individuals who are vulnerable often suffer. Lots of individuals don't have access to this international legal realm. There's lots of people that suffer in the world. And so, you know, to say that this is, you know, simply marching along and we're going to arrive at it is problematic. And in an interesting way, it also denies agency. It denies agency in the same way that Agamben denied agency. If these migrants and asylum seekers are simply harbingers of a new sense of global justice, it kind of implants them in this process in which they're not actively creating the new sense of global justice. They're simply kind of following the path that globalization has set in front of them. So in more subtle ways, it denies the agency of migrants and asylum seekers. So that's kind of the second, more optimistic perspective. But my own perspective is kind of different. It sees the way to understand these developments as rooted in a framework of this as a radical democratic project, what I call an agonistic political project, one which continually forces us to rethink the boundaries of citizenship and belonging. And so to wrap up, I'll claim that this framework actually enables us to truly see the cases I've presented as spaces for radically democratic forms of agonistic political mobilization. And I'll say a little bit about that term, agonistic. Agonistic, it's a vein of democratic theory that is really kind of radical democratic theory. It sees politics as characterized by struggle and contestation, and always characterized by struggle and contestation. That is kind of, you know, the condition of democratic life. To the extent that there is not struggle and contestation, we should question the legitimacy of the democracy in which we reside. It's a democratic space which resists closure. Ideas and outcomes should be subject to challenge. They should be subject to revision. And even in terms of policy outcomes, you know, there are temporary winners and losers in these conflicts, but we return to these outcomes and we subject them to radical political contestation.
You're listening to a talk by Professor Robert Glover of the Honors and Political Sciences Departments at the University of Maine's Socialist and Marxist Studies Lecture Series last week.
So I'll say a little bit more about how this notion of democracy connects to what we're seeing in relation to citizenship and migration. A core idea that informs this agonistic understanding is the notion that democracy is an inherently unfinished process. So democracy through this lens, it's not a set of institutions, it's not a regime type, it's not a mode of political order. but it's this promise. It's the inherent but unknowable promise of a future condition. And French thinker Jacques Derrida refers to this condition as democracy to come. This is not a future condition in the sense of like Ben Habib's liberal cosmopolitan order that functions as a regulative ideal, but rather it's democracy to come is, quote, not a promise whose fulfillment at some future point in time can be expected, foreseen, or described. Democracy to come does not name a future democracy, nor is its promise ever embodied in an empirical political regime. The promise always remains a promise. So it's this inherently unfinished promise. The notion of democracy is a future condition. It's unknowable because to the extent that we reach some general consensus about the proper vision for a democratic society, then paradoxically the demos, the people, would become irrelevant. So that is to say that dissent operates as the condition of possibility for a truly democratic regime. The second aspect of this understanding of agonistic democracy is what's called undecidability. Also drawn from Derrida. It parallels democracy to come, this notion of undecidability. But Derrida argues that if we're to engage in ethical and political judgment, our decisions must occur against the field of undecidability. That's a form of active decision-making where judgment can't be reduced to calculation or determination. The condition transcends the mere formulaic following of rules or adherence to guidelines. Derrida went so far as to suggest that undecidability was the necessary condition for any free and political action. He writes, a decision which did not go through the ordeal of the undecidable would not be a free decision. It would only be the programmable application or the unfolding of a calculable process. It might be legal, it would not be just. And through this frame, we can make a distinction between the sovereign application of law and the active decision-making and judgment that lay at the core of seeking justice. And this understanding, it bears not only upon how we understand democracy, but how we understand ourselves as citizens. It's, you know, democracy is partly about closure. We have to make decisions, we have to constitute political identities, but the notion of undecidability suggests that those are based on an incomplete or an imperfect conception of the people. Alan Keenan, another democratic theorist, writes that the closure necessary to the people's identity and rule, then, in a paradox typical of democratic self-rule, means that the people never, in fact, completely closes in on itself. It never reaches completion or achievement. So we have a notion of the citizen, but it remains open to reconsideration. Another idea which informs this perspective is the idea of dissensus. And this comes from French thinker Jacques Rancière. Dissensus, so in thinking about these partial acts of closure in relation to human rights and resistance by marginalized political subjects, when we think about them as acts of dissensus, then they take on a productive and a constructive character, and it's performative. So in short, these acts of resistance that we see, they perform and construct new notions of rights. The performative notion of rights and rights claiming, Jacques Rancière writes, there is no man in the rights of man, but there's no need for such a man. The strength of those rights lies in the back and forth movement between the first inscription of the right and the dissensual stage on which it is put to the state. That is why subjects of the Soviet Constitution could make reference to the rights of man against the laws that deny their effectivity. This is why citizens of states ruled by religious law or the mere arbitrariness of their governments, even the clandestine immigrants in zones of transit of our countries, of the populations in the camps of refugees, can invoke them. These rights are theirs when they can do something with them to construct a dissensus against the denial of the rights they suffer. So, in a similar fashion to Derrida, Rancière claims that to envision the citizen as the only political subject who can press rights claims against the state is to depoliticize those struggles. And so we can think then about these individuals in making a claim to rights, migrants and asylum seekers, and a whole host of individuals, right? Anyone who is marginalized and oppressed, anyone who makes a rights claim from a position of non-recognition or marginalization, they're exposing the space between formal legal rights and the practical recognition of those rights. Political subjects who reside on the margins of the political community, they expose the gap between rights and recognition. And they distinguish between that formulaic application of law, sovereign legality, and the domains in which we enact claims to justice. And they actually inaugurate new forms of rights, but they do so in advance of their recognition. So before the state recognizes the legitimacy of a right, they make these claims in advance of their recognition. And that kind of gets us into the directionality of rights claims. In this conception, rights claims kind of point beyond themselves, if that makes sense. There's a political theorist, Bonnie Honig, and she says that this possibility of anticipatory rights claims occurring absent solid foundation and occurring absent a universal or a particular form of political membership, there's something really promising in that. In dominant conceptualizations of the directionality of political and social struggles, Honig critiques the idea that new rights claims are often judged in terms of the rights' amenability to existing categories, existing conditional or universal categories. So we judge rights claims that are fundamentally new rights claims, like the claims of rights we saw at the outset. We judge them in relation to the existing system of rights that we have and the existing political and legal system in which we reside. But what those rights claims are trying to do is really create a new system. And so we can't judge in the moment whether or not those rights are legitimate. Honig argues that there may well come what we later call progress. New identities may be allowed or ushered onto the threshold of justice, but progress does not come with its own guarantee. Nor is it a meaningful criterion to guide us. In the moment, we don't know what progress might consist. We don't know in what progress might consist, and new claims may seem laughable. Looking backward, we can say with satisfaction that the logic of rights required and therefore delivered the eventual inclusion of women, African Americans, Native peoples into the schedule of formal rights. But what actually did the work? The impulsion of rights or the political actors who won the battle. So this is an agency-centered conception of rights, and it sees the act of advancing a rights claim from a position of marginalization or vulnerability as, in effect, creating a new reality, performing and constructing the situation that leads to a new reality. So Honig's point, then, is that dominant understandings of rights, they paper over that uncertainty, that fragility of the rights claim at the moment that it's voiced. And such conceptualizations of rights are these unproblematic tales of victors and vanquished, and they're purged of their ambivalence. And dominant conceptualizations of rights, as a result of that, they risk minimizing the political agency of those who voice the rights claim, or who, quote, usher such demands onto the threshold of justice. So to adopt that linear logic of rights is to insist that successful attempts to establish a new claim to justice were in nascent form already somehow part of the rights machine, simply waiting to be uncovered, instantiated, and codified into law. But a more critical assessment would suggest that performative rights claims, like anything which challenges the existing order, they'll be met with uncertainty. We won't know how to receive these claims because they are fundamentally new. And that critical perspective suggests to us the agonistic character of political claims making. The initiation of rights claims, even those rights which transcend the existing order of recognition, embodies the initiation of a struggle over the meaning of those rights as well as their potential claimants. So linking this back to the idea of the resistance of non-citizens, this is kind of the last substantive point I'll make, but what do migrants and asylum seekers kind of do for us? What does this form of resistance enable us to realize? Well, the very identity of the migrant or the refugee or the asylum seeker or the undocumented immigrant, it forces us to rethink the moments of closure that we encounter when we examine the citizenship migration nexus in practice. These identities And these political subjects, they resist this formulaic account of inside versus outside and citizen versus non-citizen. And in particular, non-citizen resistance, which actively contests the closure of the community or fights removal from that community, it moves us beyond membership as a category to which sovereign power can be applied. And it forces us to question and rethink the limits of membership. So utilizing those theoretical and conceptual frames above, these actions don't merely create the backdrop for the application of power, but rather the condition for the possibility of justice. So if we're to think about justice in expansive ways, movements like this are really important because they contest in some fundamental way the boundaries of inclusion and exclusion, but also justice, right? Because those two things are linked. So to conclude, if we think about the ways that non-citizens engage in contentious politics, in protest movements, what do we learn? Well, one, we learn that these examples show us that citizenship is not this fixed and enduring status. It's an evolving site of political contestation. The rights and belonging that we attach to membership, those are subject to periodic reconsideration as well. And that's, what, in fact, what these individuals are calling for. So these actors, they create these spaces, these political spaces and these points of struggle and spaces of empowerment where seemingly none exist. Right? We would look at those individuals and we would say they're powerless, but in fact, they find spaces of empowerment within spaces of powerlessness. Second, in this era of human rights, we're more attuned than ever in human history to consider claims of injustice and to think about ways in which we might rectify them. But the crucial question is how we judge such moments, how we judge the instances in which those subject to marginalization and oppression stage dissensus. At times, the human rights discourse seems to know in advance what type of democratic discourse or what type of democratic claims making is capable of actually advancing human rights. But we can only really make that assessment in retrospect. Right? So these individuals, because what they're engaged in is so radical, they're contesting the very boundaries of the political community, it forces us to rethink that in a really fundamental way. And also, the migrants and asylum seekers here, they have the ability to foster reconsiderations of the ways in which we understand rights and belonging and justice. So alongside our fears of non-citizens as representative of this world beyond our borders that's in some way threatening to us, they also kind of affirm certain things about our own political citizenship. Right? If we think about this in relation to our own struggles against the government, or the ways in which we experience injustice, we have to rethink our own powerlessness. If individuals who are in these abject conditions in which their lives are incredibly hard, that they still find ways to resist the state, if they can do that, then that kind of opens this space for us to rethink our own powerlessness as well. And then lastly, I think clearly here, we gain a sense of the ways in which human rights really takes on a performative character here. These individuals, they are attempting to construct and create this entirely different conception of what human rights ought to mean, and a form of rights claiming that transcends the way that we traditionally think about it, that's resistance-based, action-based, and doesn't have any kind of rosy endpoint. It's just about slowing the wheels of the state, in any way they can. So I think this points out kind of the performative nature of human rights, but also how human rights, there is no transcendent logic to it, but ultimately it's this kind of fragile thing that really involves human beings simply engaged in promising to fellow human beings. And so that's really significant. So I think these are interesting and fascinating cases, but I think that they point out the fact that rights and rights claims reside in every one of us. It's our notion of the promise of a desirable future, our ability to engage in acts of promising to our fellow human beings, and also our capacity to kind of periodically reimagine our political and legal systems and construct new ones. And through this form of radical challenge, immigrants and asylum seekers provide that for us. So I'll wrap up there. Thanks.
That was Professor Robert Glover of the Honors and Political Sciences Department speaking at the University of Maine's Socialist and Marxist Studies Lecture Series last week. His talk was recorded by John Greenman. You've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal. I'm Amy Brown. Thanks for listening.
As they drill for quick corporate profits deep inside our earth, such natural gas frackers as ExxonMobil